came up to your groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. And so that's kind of how the great conflict that drives the beginning of the book of Exodus starts. And we're talking about demons in particular. And there's one aspect of demons. Well, we'll get to the whole demon possession thing hopefully before the night's over. But it's important to see the larger picture in which the demonic sits in the Bible, and something that's often easily missed. And it actually goes all the way back to the beginning of God's struggle to claim a people out of the human race, right? You know, you have the book of Genesis, it's the fall of man. It's the promise to Abraham, traced through the patriarchs, the four generations, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. And yes, Joseph is technically the firstborn, becomes the firstborn of Jacob's family. If you want to know more about that, take a class on Genesis. But that's why it's Manasseh and Ephraim, just that he got the birthright. He becomes Jacob's firstborn. So it's four generations of the patriarchal promise. That's the idea. But that fourth generation, they wind up in Egypt. And we talked about this a little bit earlier in the quarter, that, you know, the book of Exodus and the Exodus itself really are the great miracle of the Bible and kind of the great type of the great New Testament deliverance, in that it is, we looked at this earlier in the quarter, when in Exodus chapter 6, when God and Moses are having their initial conversation, early conversations. And God makes the point to Moses that, you know, the patriarchs knew me by El Shaddai, but they did not know me by Yahweh. You know, but now, in a sense, I'm going to reveal myself by that name. And the idea was not that the name was not known. The idea was that the full force of the meaning was not known. In other words, that God has not really publicly worked with the human race. He's worked patriarchally, he's worked in family, but he's not done anything really spectacular. Yes, the flood, but again, everybody died. In terms of the way that is meant to kind of separate the righteous from the wicked and wake people up and force them to make a choice about who they will serve. And so the book of Exodus is the beginning of God reasserting himself on the human race, a great motif throughout the Bible of God against the nations, right? I mean, even going all the way back to Psalm 2, that classic messianic psalm. Who do you need?
The chair.
Oh, the chair, yeah, sure, if you want it. Absolutely.
Good luck with that.
I started to turn it around and face it that way.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, yeah, we can move the garbage cans up if you'd rather. Huh?
I could be the one for the hard of hearing.
That's right. Anyways. You know, the great, you know, motif in the Bible is kind of God against the nations. Go all the way back to Babel, right, when God first makes the nations out of human rebellion. You with me? And so you fall to the great messianic psalm, why do the nations rage? And God's ultimate answer to the nation raging is appointing what or who? The Messiah, who will rule with the rod of iron, a motif that becomes an important part of the New Testament. Jesus is the king. My kingdom is not of this world. All the way through the book of Revelation, where he is described as the one with the rod of iron. God versus the nations. God revealing himself to the human race again and telling the human race, make a choice. And that begins here in Exodus, where the nations are against God's people. That's a motif all the way to the book of Revelation, isn't it? The suffering, martyred people at the altar. How long ago, Lord? I mean, you with me? This great kind of cosmic, throughout history, struggle. God's people versus those who are not just rebelling against God, but ultimately shown to be under, in one sense, the power of the beast. Use Revelation's language. The dragon and his beasts, those who he works through on earth. And so you start all the way back here, Exodus 2, with the people, God's people, God's covenant people, crying out for deliverance. This is the Old Testament version of how long, O Lord? And so God hears, God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. And so God will begin revealing himself publicly to the human race again, without, like, literally destroying everybody, like in the flood. Revealing himself, that's what it meant by, I've not made my name known until now. Now the world is going to know what it means that Yahweh is Lord again. And so you remember what happens now, right? God sends Moses, he goes back to see Pharaoh. Pharaoh says, who is this? Who is this God that I should listen? Who is this one? And so there's a series of 10 plagues. ten plagues that are that God used and Moses bring upon Egypt. And the important part that we often miss in Exodus chapter 12, as the Passover is announced, this is the meal that will become the permanent feast. But this is the original meal that Israel is to eat that night, waiting for the deliverance as the destroyer passes through and the firstborn of Egypt are slain. But what's important there is the way it's put in Exodus 12 and verse 12. For I will pass through the land of Egypt that night, and I will strike all the firstborn of the land of Egypt, both man and beast. And it doesn't say he's judging Pharaoh in verse 12. What does it say he's judging? The gods of Egypt is who he's judging. Now you say, wait a second, Jeff, I didn't think the gods were real. Yeah, no, they're really not. But the Bible, and starting here in Exodus and in the Pentateuch, is doing something that we often miss. That actually goes all the way into the New Testament. We miss this too. We're just saying that, you know, there are no real other gods, but there is a sinister spiritual reality out there that is actually what you're worshiping, whether you realize it or not, when you rebel against God. And so God tells Moses and tells Israel that this is actually a judgment on the gods of Egypt. Now, the quintessential struggle in one sense, here still next to this, the quintessential struggle in one sense and part of the original request that God through Moses makes to Pharaoh is not just let my people go. We you know, maybe we get a little too focused on Yul Brynner versus Charlton Heston sometimes and that version of it. But that's not all Moses actually said to Pharaoh about the reason and the point and the purpose of letting his people go. Anybody remember what the larger purpose of God was for letting them go? Is it just so Israel could go do whatever they wanted on spring break?
To worship him.
To worship him. Exodus chapter 10, verse 3. So Moses and Aaron went into Pharaoh and said to him, thus says Yahweh, God of the Hebrews, how long will you refuse to humble yourself before me? Let my people go that they may serve or worship me. And so the real issue is, and this is something that, again, we need to understand even as the people of God now, we are not, you know, and I've seen, you know, other religious groups and people who are reading bad religious literature, you know, the whole idea of free in Christ, that we're free, you know, you're not free to do whatever you want in life. God wasn't freeing Israelite slaves to do whatever they wanted once they were out of Egypt. They were being freed from Egyptian slavery to what purpose? To worship and serve their God. That's why God was liberating them, not so they can go live their best life now or any other free in Christ, you know, that's what grace is for kind of rhetoric. They were freed to worship. And that's important to understand that that's the fundamental even conflict between God and the devil. Think about it this way. When the devil confronts Jesus in Matthew's gospel, Matthew chapter 4, it's actually the last temptation. It's flipped in Luke, but in Matthew 4, it's the last temptation. And what is the last temptation that Satan actually pushes towards Jesus? If you will and worship me, then I'll let you have all this stuff. And we talk about, yes, you know, that he's offered him a kingdom without a cross, all that. That's all true. That's all good. But what that passage also highlights, though, is what's the fundamental struggle? Who is going to worship what? That makes sense? That's the fundamental story of the human race. Who or what are you going to serve? And ultimately, in the Bible sense, who are you going to worship? And you follow that even in the book of Revelation. Again, we've been in and out of that book over the course of the quarter. We've talked about the dragon, you know, and that's actually Satan going all the way back to the garden. John's vision makes clear. And he's described as a dragon who wants to make war on the saints of God. But in particular, in fact, again, just to kind of underscore this, flip all the way back with me to Revelation chapter 13 and look again at the language that is used here. In chapter 12, the dragon is revealed to be Satan himself. He intends to make war on the people of God. How will he do that? Well, what he's going to do is literally the last sentence of chapter 12 in Revelation. And he stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising out of the sea. Now I'm into chapter 13 with 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 diadems on its horns and blasphemous names on its heads. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. And by the way, it's a mashup of Daniel's kingdoms, the beast that he saw, the kingdoms. And so how does the dragon intend to make war on the woman's children, on the people of God on earth? And it's through, ultimately, that this beast is really meant to be kind of the Roman government by political power and things like that. But here's where we're going with this. Actually, 2 weeks. Verse 6, I want you to notice what the beast does is it blasphemes God. It blasphemes God. That's what it does. And verse 7, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. On earth, the world often wins against the people of God. That's not the final word on the matter, but on earth, the world often wins. People are put to death. People lose jobs. People, you know, families are destroyed for sake of the testimony of Jesus. You with me? That's what happens. On earth, the world generally wins. And so Satan works in the world through this sea beast. But keep reading. Not only is it allowed to make war on the saints and conquer them, authority was given it over every tribe, people, language, and nation. That's the Roman Empire. And all who dwell on earth will... Oh, there's our word. This is what the real struggle is all about. Who or what are you going to worship? And there it is. And not only is it that the world will worship it, and we get that. People worship power, right? People worship politics. We've seen that again this month, haven't we? All the fretting and stressing. All the most important election in your lifetime rhetoric, as though we humans on earth have that much ultimate say over what's really going on. But keep reading. Then John says, verse 11, I saw another beast rising out of the earth now, and it had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. That's a great line. It looks religious and safe, but it speaks like who? Satan. And remember, again, just a handful of themes through the Bible just coming up with all sorts of different variations. Paul talks about this. Satan often works or reveals himself as an angel of
light.
Satan does not show up in the Halloween costume. You know, the red horns and the pitchfork and the, you know, and the tail and the cloven feet. He doesn't show up in the Halloween costume. He comes looking like something orthodox or legitimate. That's what he does. Yes, sir.
Well, in Ephesians, it tells us that the devil works through children of disobedience.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Ephesians 2:2 and also
correct.
Ephesians 6:12, and the world, it works through the darkness of the world leaders against spiritual wickedness in high places.
No, that's right. Yeah, he works through people, and that's what we're talking about here in Revelation.
Yeah. Emphasizing that in those two verses.
Absolutely. So this land beast, it's got a religious aura about it. And it exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence. So it's government endorsed. And it makes the earth and into the heavens do what? There's that word again. What's its job? Worship the beast. And so there's another means by which humanity is encouraged to worship the satanic, to serve Satan. Now, do people on earth realize that's what they're doing? No. No, we may not fear God, but we don't think we're being, you know, we're flat-out Satan worshipers. The fact of the matter is, if you don't worship God, what are you, in one sense, what revelation, from Exodus to Revelation, what are we being told we're really worshiping if we're not worshiping God? There's only two options.
Right.
And if you're not worshiping God intentionally and actively, by default, who or what are you worshiping?
Man.
Well, but beyond that, underneath that,
the beast.
All right, so back to what's going on here. It's interesting, then, that you see this theme. You know, we see in Exodus, it's God says, I'm really judging the gods of Egypt. What's that about? Well, as the Pentateuch goes on, we begin to understand a little bit more, or see a little bit more, you know, part of what God is implying. Leviticus chapter 17, this comes right after the Day of Atonement ritual, right? One of the most important days in the Jewish calendar, where God takes the blood, or allows the high priest rather to take the blood behind the veil, sprinkle it there to both atone for the sins of the people and even to cleanse the tabernacle itself, just existing among sinful people kind of pollutes God's space. And so it's kind of the annual fumigation, if you will, of the temple as well, so that its holiness may be maintained and God may dwell there. And so right here in Leviticus chapter 17, and the first part of 17 really kind of dovetails onto the end of the Day of Atonement chapter there in 16, we get that famous language about how important blood is, that life is in the blood, that this is why sacrifice matters to God, that the blood kind of symbolizes life and the trading of life for life. But there's this quirky line in here, and we looked at it last week. This was our cliffhanger ending. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and his sons and all the people of Israel, saying, this is the thing that the Lord has commanded. If anyone of Israel kills an ox or a lamb or a goat in the camp, or kills it outside the camp, and does not bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting to offer as a gift to the Lord in front of the tabernacle of the Lord, blood guilt shall be imputed to that man. Part of what's happening now that we have the tabernacle is God does not want people religiously sacrificing animals wherever they want. you must bring it to the tabernacle. In other words, to do it under the priest, do it under God's auspices. God is not the God of confusion. He is the God of decently and in order. And so that principle is actually throughout the Bible. And again, blood guilt to the person who does not do this. Verse 5, why else does this matter to God? Because if I have to bring my sacrifice to the tabernacle and eventually the temple, and I can't just do it wherever I want, then I can't actually be using sacrifice in pagan ways. Well, why would they do that? Well, because they grew up in Egypt, because the world is strong. In fact, the influence of the world is strong. In fact, by the time you get to the end of Israel's period in land, prophet Ezekiel, God shows Ezekiel idolatry within the temple itself. The gods had moved into God's own house, actually, got so bad. So anyway, so this is one of God's ways of, if they followed the law, to make sure that people could not be secretly at home participating in pagan ideology, pagan worship. This is to the end that verse 5, the people of Israel may bring their sacrifices, if they sacrifice in the open field, that they may bring them to the Lord, to the priest. That's the key. God's ordained supervision to the priest at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and sacrifice them as sacrifices of peace offerings to the Lord. And the priest will throw the blood of the altar, the blood on the altar of the Lord at the tent of meeting, burn the fat for pleasing the Lord. Verse 7, that's it. This is our key verse. So they shall no more, because the priest is watching now. Can't do this in your garage anymore. Nobody knows what you're really doing. This may be so that they may no more make their sacrifices to goat demons, the demonic. Well, I thought I was worshiping Baal, or I thought I was worshiping Ishtar, or Ashtaroth, or whoever, Molech. Well, yeah, that may be the name you're pronouncing or thinking of as you do your thing, but what's God say is really underneath it?
Demons.
The demons, the demonic. You're serving Satan. It's the demonic underneath that. And this will be a statute forever for them throughout their generations. And that's why, and because this is such a big deal in verses 8 and 9, anyone of the house of Israel or of the strangers who sojourn among them who offers a burnt offering or sacrifice and does not bring it to the tent of meeting to offer to the Lord, that man shall be cut off from his people. All right. Worship, and God's worship is what it's all about. That is where the rubber meets the road. And if you're not worshiping God, by default, you're worshiping the demonic. You're worshiping Satan. For the Pentateuch's over, Deuteronomy 32. Moses, again, one last time before he dies, drives this point home to Israel. I'm going to start reading in verse 15 of Deuteronomy 32. But Yeshurun, and that is another name for the people collectively, Israel. In Hebrew, means something like my upright one, which I think was probably, if you understand the overall context of the Song of Moses, it's probably meant to be a mocking title, because is Israel going to be an upright people? No. And if you read the whole Song of Moses, it's almost prophetic in terms of foretelling the people's coming disobedience, future disobedience, and rebellion against God. In fact, as one preacher friend of mine put it one time when we were sitting talking about Deuteronomy, he said, how would you like it if God, before your great, George Washington dies, gives you your national anthem by inspiration, and its title is, You're Going to Fail? Because that's essentially what the Song of Moses is. And it's actually meant to be a prophetic warning of, despite everything that has been given you in the law, the miracles God's bringing to the land, you're still not going to keep the law. To that end, one of the ways you're not going to keep the law, verse 15, but Yeshurun, my upright one, grew fat and kicked. You grew fat, stout, and sleek. And it's the image of an animal that's well fed. In other words, the blessing of God, you're comfortable, you're prosperous. You can tell the difference between a dog that's homeless on the street and a dog that has a home, right? How can you tell?
Skinny versus fat.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the image God is picking on here. So Yeshurun grew fat and kicked. You grew fat, stout, and sleek. Why? Because God feeds you so well. God has taken care of his people with the blessings of the covenant of Abraham. But when he became fat, stout, sleek, what? He forsook God who made him and scoffed at the rock of his salvation. They, talking about the people, they stirred him, that's God. They stirred God to jealousy. How? With strange gods. With abominations they provoked him. And look at the next verse. We're back to the same thing we just saw in Leviticus 17. What are they actually doing?
Sacrificing
to demons that are not gods. Now, they may be calling them gods. Again, pick your name. From Baal to Ashtaroth to Molech to Chemosh to whoever. Name whatever deity you want to, but underneath it, what are you really worshiping? Just like we saw in Revelation. Pick your era, pick your age, pick the name of the government, pick the religion, whatever. Whatever name of whatever era. What's underneath anything that is not the worship of God? The worship of the satanic and the demonic. That's, in fact, what you're doing. So, no, doesn't mean that they're a real God. The gods are really anything like that. He makes that clear in verse 17. They sacrifice the demons that were no gods. They're not really rivals of God. They're not really alternatives. But in the pagan mindset, what you're really doing is you're giving Satan what he really wanted. To new gods that had come recently whom your fathers had never dreaded. And so you were unfaithful to the rock that bore you, and you forgot the rock who gave you birth. You made you sleek and fat, you know, in other words, a prosperous life. And how did you return the favor and your prosperity?
Turned away and worshiped
the demonic. That idea, that mindset, prevails all the way into the New Testament. A couple of three places I want you to look at. I mean, actually, you know what? One last place in the Old Testament before we go to the New. Go to Psalm 106. One last place. And I'm going to pick up in verse, I'm going to pick up in verse 34. And what you have here in Psalm 106 is a historical psalm in which the psalmist is rehearsing the not always uplifting history of the people in the land. And when you pick up in verse 34, they did not destroy the people. It's talking about the Canaanites, right? Joshua's day, when they go in the land. What was God's instruction? Wipe them out. If you don't wipe them out, what's going to happen?
Come back at you.
You're going to wind up just like them worshiping their gods. That was the real issue, right? You're going to follow their gods, their ways. So, verse 24, they did not destroy the peoples as the Lord commanded them, but they mixed with the nations. What's the chief way of mixing by the nations?
Intermarrying.
This matters because if the clock doesn't move too fast tonight, we're going to get there. Intermarriage is the chief way of God's people mixing with the world. Okay? That's an important thing to remember. They mixed with the nations and learned to do as they did. They served their idols, which became a snare to them. They sacrificed their sons and daughters. The human sacrifice. But look, there it is again. It wasn't Molech, really. What are you really doing? You're worshiping Satan. That's what you're really doing. And the demonic underneath that. That's what you're really doing. And so the land was polluted with blood. By the way, the name of that god today is called Choice. And the land is just as filled with blood. Because some things never change. Some things never change. And again, I am not God. I do not know God's ways or timing, but I know God's patterns. And we live in a nation that, when given the gift of a Supreme Court that overruled one of the most monstrous rights that is no right, the right to destroy unborn life, a number of states in this nation chose last week to re-enshrine that legal right. That's not about politics, folks, as David reminds us in a sermon recently. That's about morality and right and wrong. It's about the nature of the image of God in us and not thinking that we have the right to play God with life and death. And what I read in the Bible tells me God in heaven's watching as we now make these choices. We were given as a people these choices back into our hands democratically. And we as a people, by and large, are choosing to re-enshrine that when given the option. I tremble. We serve the demonic in this country with that kind of stuff. It is about worship then. Again, you'll notice it was about worship there. John chapter 4. Jesus does not mention the demonic, but in a famous and familiar exchange with the Samaritan woman at the well, the question is about worship. She wants to know which mountain, right? The Samaritans had a different tradition. They misread the Pentateuch. And they had an idea about which mountain God was supposed to be worshipped on. Of course, the Jews said it's on Zion in Jerusalem there where the temple is. And she asked Jesus to get involved in the dispute. Which mountain is it really, Jesus? And everybody remembers kind of Jesus' famous answer, but I want you to think about it from the angle that we're talking about now with the whole point of humanity is worship. Who or what you're worshiping. He says to her, verse 21, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father." You don't realize that the end of this whole system's at hand anyways. Your question's about to become irrelevant. You worship what you do not know. We worship, we talk about we Jews, we worship what we do know, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth. We usually use that for a variety of other applications, but I just want you to keep thinking about that language from this angle tonight. At the end of the day, what is God looking for? He's looking for people who are
worshipers.
The struggle for the soul of the human race comes down to who is mankind going to worship? Who or what's mankind going to worship? That's what it all comes down to. And that's there, that conversation. All right. Now, Gaynor had this in Ephesians a few minutes ago, and he was right to do so. Two Pauline passages. Well, one is Ephesians 3. I will quickly, again, reiterate, Gaynor kind of was feeling his way ahead of us. Well done. Ephesians 3, look at the language of Paul. Part of what's going on, I'm going to start reading verse 7. Of this gospel, Paul here says, I was made a minister according to the gift of God's grace, which was given to me by the working of his power. To me, though I am the very least of all the saints, the grace was given to preach to the Gentiles the unsearchable riches of Christ and to bring to light for everyone what is the plan of the mystery hidden for ages in God, who created all things. In other words, finally, what God had in mind when he made the world in the first place, because God knew sin was going to happen. He had all this in mind. God knew the end from the beginning. And so now that Jesus has come and gone, the apostles, Paul in particular, are being given by God the revelation to the human race about what God's really up to, where this is all headed, what's the point of all this? At least as far as God's going to tell us. But finally, mankind is being let in on the mystery, hidden for ages in God who created all things. So that through the church, through the people of God on earth in particular, though actually not just on earth, I mean here it's actually a universal sense, through the church, the manifold wisdom of God might now be made known, but notice to who he says. To the rulers and authorities, where? And this was according to the eternal purpose that he has realized in Christ Jesus our Lord. God's eternal purpose was not just you and I's salvation. That's part of it. But in our salvation, God was also making a point to somebody's. To what? Or to who? The spiritual beings. And so what he has done in us, just like God, now think about this, go back to the image of God's people in the Old Testament we saw in the book of Exodus. God's real struggle, or struggle is not a good word, God's real work in confronting Pharaoh and bringing his people out was to send a message to who about what? To Pharaoh or to mankind about the demons, about the gods that are no gods. What did he say? This night I judge who or what?
Gods of Egypt.
The gods of Egypt. Who's watching the drama on earth? The spiritual beings, good and bad. Right? We talked about the angels. Do they desire to know more about what God is up to? Are they curious about us? Yeah, we saw that. Peter talks about that. Is he also making a point to the demonic? Yeah. The human drama and God's work in human history is also God's way of showing the spiritual beings that he is God and there is no other as well. And what he's doing is just like in Exodus, the actual deliverance was a humiliation of the gods that are no gods. They're demons masquerading as something they're not, so to speak. Now, this side of the cross, Paul says, okay, God's really let you in on a little bit of a deeper secret. It's not just about you. He, through you, is making a point to these spiritual beings. That again, he can show them that they are nothing and deliver his people, not just from some you know, ancient Near Eastern monarch 3,000 years, 3,500 years ago, but he can do it from Satan himself in the ultimate way. And that's going to set up where we're going to get here at the end of the quarter, the idea of Jesus as victor over the spiritual beings. He is a conqueror. In fact, and Paul's got a scene on that here in Ephesians that we'll get to for the quarter's over. All right, last place, Paul, in a warning to Christians, of 1 Corinthians chapter 10. In the context here, Paul's been asked a question by the Corinthian Christians, can we eat meat that has been sacrificed to idols? And the corollary question of that, which is also not just, if the answer to that is yes, then can we eat that meat in the idol's temple. Now, let me understand a little bit, explain real quick a little bit about ancient background and how this worked in Corinth and pagan temples. Pagan temple, okay. False religion is lucrative. Any era, any time, any place. Full stop. Stop right there, okay? There's lots of gold and there's lots of money involved in false religion. In the Greco-Roman context, one of the ways it looked like was people would bring sacrificial animals to, you know, Apollo, you know, Aphrodite, no, be Diana, Artemis, whoever, all these various gods. They'd bring their sacrifices, and the priests would get a cup. Part of why the early Christians wrestled with whether that was okay to eat meat, sacrifice to idol, was what those temples did, one of the things those temples did, those pagan temples did, with the leftover meat, was they turned around to the wholesalers. That became the grocery store meat. So you go to, you know, pick wherever you like to go, from Walmart to HEB, we got people bowl pipes in here, wherever you like to go get your meat, you were almost guaranteed that when you went to HEB or Kroger or Walmart Aldi, wherever you were getting your meat from, when you went to the meat market, that meat's original source was a pagan ritual. And part of how the temples were getting so filthy, which was selling out the excess out the back door, and that became the grocery store meat. So if you were a Christian, it was really hard to eat meat that was not in some way previously involved in the pagan ritual. And so you as a Christian were wondering, if I eat meat, especially at all, but in general, you know, if I know that Kroger meat always comes from the Temple of Apollo, you know, that's where they get that, that's where it's wholesale from. Am I in some way participating? Compromised? If I buy my meat at Kroger or whatever. And Paul's basic answer is no. I mean, it's just meat. Because the gods are nothing, really. There's no reality to them. However, and I'm paraphrasing a lot, you go back and read chapters 8, 9, and 10 tonight. We're not doing that for sake of time. However, Paul says, if somebody says, oh, by the way, that's a great cut of meat because I got that from Apollo's temple, they're always a great source of meat, now you don't eat it. Why? Not for your own sake, because you still know the gods are nothing in one sense, and it's just meat. But for that guy's sake, because now he thinks that you know it's Apollo's meat, you're going to eat it with consciousness of Apollo. That makes sense? Not for your sake. You know it's still just meat, man. And, you know, and at the end of the day, we're in Texas, and it's brisket. But for that guy's sake, don't do it. But the corollary problem, so now that Paul said, okay, it's okay to eat meat in general, you know, as long as you aren't actually actively, you know, joining in somebody's, you know, we're eating this meat in honor of Apollo today or something. So what happens if somebody invites you to actually eat it in the dining room at the temple? Because temples had dining rooms. Another way of making money. You could actually have that stuff cooked to order right then and there and eat it in Apollo's temple and invite whoever you want. And again, we have all sorts of stuff for the Greco-Roman world. We have invitations to meals at pagan temples. I mean, this was part of social life. This was like the company Christmas party, you know, when you're at a steakhouse downtown. This stuff happened. So now you're a Christian. You've been invited not just to eat meat that probably came from an idol's worship, but now you've been invited to eat it with your co-workers or guild members or whatever in the idol's temple itself. What do you do now? And Paul's answer in chapter 10 goes back to what we've been talking about tonight. I'm going to start in verse 14. Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. I speak as a sensible people. Judge for yourselves what I say. The cup of blessing that we bless, is it not a participation in the blood of Christ? He's probably talking about the cup at the Lord's Supper here. You know, he's going to really do. He's going to set up a comparison. The Lord's table versus the pagan table. So when I come to the Lord's table, am I not participating in the blood of Christ? Isn't that what happens when we come together on the first day of the week, and especially, you know, the cup, you know, we remind ourselves of Jesus' words, take, drink, this is my blood shed for you, et cetera, et cetera. And we understand that we are, you know, in some way participating in remembering, you know, that's what's going on there. That's what's underneath it. And the bread that we break by the same token. You know, what were Jesus' words? Take, eat, this is my body broken for you. And so we're doing that with consciousness of and recognition of the body of the Lord. Because there is one bread, we who are many are one body. We're unified around that. That's why we sometimes call it communion, right? We are all sharing in it together. Verse 18, consider the people of Israel. Are not those who eat the sacrifices participants in the altar? What do I imply then? That food offered to idols is anything? Are the idols anything? No, again, they're not gods. We know better than that. No, I imply that what pagan sacrifice they offer to, and there it is again, all the way from the Old Testament to the New. What's, even for the Greco-Roman world, what are you still doing if you're participating in that?
Sacrificing the demons.
there it is, and not to God, and I do not want you to be participants with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord. Don't you can't go to church on Sunday, gather on the table of the Lord, you know, in the Lord's Supper, drink the Lord's cup, and then come here on Tuesday night at the office party in Apollo's temple and drink the cup of demons. You can't do that. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. That puts a little starker face on the pagan idolatry, doesn't it? Yes, they're not gods, but that doesn't mean that there's not nothing going on there. Yeah, there's no such thing as Apollo or Artemis. They're not gods. But is there still a serious spiritual reality at stake in this? And Paul says, yes, all the way back to Exodus, deep spiritual reality underneath all of this. If you are not worshiping God by default, who or what are you worshiping? No matter what you do, where you go, what you profess, you are participating in the demonic simply because you are not worshiping God and obeying God. That makes sense? All right. Is that clock accurate? I got about 3 minutes. Is that right?
Yep.
Oh, good. Just in time for Genesis 6 then.
This is 9:05, not 8:05.
Yeah, we're in real trouble now. So going back, a couple of hard passages we kind of... No, I'm not going to do that. I know I can do real quick for sake of time. Let's talk about something else. Set aside Genesis 6. I'll let a sub handle that next week when I'm off. now I get no subs. Let's talk about demon possession for a minute. Does it happen in the Bible?
Yes.
But I want you to think about something. I don't know if you've thought about this way or not. Does it happen consistently across? Does it happen consistently across the Bible?
No.
Do you see demon possession by and large in the Old Testament?
No.
Where do you almost solely see demon possession in the Bible?
Jesus.
Nowhere in Scripture explicitly says why, but I think a faithful reading of Scripture, especially Jesus' own words, especially in John's Gospel, which ironically does not involve him in demonic conflict, like the synoptics, but Jesus says, now I have come to what? To judge the ruler of this world. Why does the demonic show up in Jesus' ministry by and large and nowhere else, with a couple of exceptions in the book of Acts? Simple. If Jesus has come to have the ultimate conflict between God, man, and Satan, what God is allowing Satan to do? Do we see in the Bible a pattern of God allowing Satan sometimes a longer leash, sometimes a less of a leash? Correct answer is yes. Just ask Job about that. Does God allow sometimes Satan to do more? You know, did Satan get permission? Yes, he did. Does Satan ask God for permission sometimes? Yep. See that in the book of Job. Even during Jesus' own ministry, what does Jesus say to Peter just before he's betrayed? Peter, Simon, what? Satan has asked for you to sift you like wheat. What God seemed to have done, I think, is a faithful interpretation of what's going on when Jesus himself is saying, this is basically, you know, this is the ultimate conflict between God, man, and Satan in my ministry right here, right now on earth, coming in the cross when the seed of woman crushes the serpent's head. God allows Satan one last chance to take his best shot. But God only allows Satan to go as far as God himself is prepared to get involved. Is God here among man in the ultimate sense?
No.
Well, Emmanuel, God with us.
Yes.
There we go. And he allows Satan to do the same. Satan, God, you know, one of the ways to think about what Satan's work all ultimately is, Satan doesn't create anything. What Satan does is corrupts, and he corrupts by counterfeiting. Does that make sense? And so God becomes flesh and dwelt among us. He gives Satan to do his best work as well. And what happens to the demonic when it encounters Jesus?
Nothing good.
Loses.
It loses instantly. It's not even a challenge. You know? What do the demons actually beg him for? It's mercy. Have you come to torment us before the time? Mark chapter 5, they're asking Jesus for permission. Well, can we at least go to the swine? Jesus is in no way on his heels. The demonic wilts in the face of God come to make war on Satan in the form of human being himself. All right, that's where we're out of time for this week.
Charles?